Welcome to IPC's podcast, Global Electronics, The Art of the Possible. I'm John Mitchell, podcast host and president and CEO of IPC, the global association that helps manufacturers build electronics better through proven standards, certification and training, advocacy, and industry intelligence. Digital technologies are transforming manufacturing and creating the fourth industrial revolution in an increasingly interconnected and globalized world. We need to start talking about the policy, sustainability, network, and workforce adoptions integral to developing the factory of the future. We want to take a broad look at some of the opportunities and challenges of creating and running the factory of the future and talk one-on-one with the industry leaders and pioneers in manufacturing and management. Join us in exploring the factory of the future. Today, I'm sitting with David Heller, the CEO of Heller Industries, and Dave, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're talking a little bit about factories of the future, and so let's jump right in and let me ask you a few questions. So while artificial intelligence and robotics could yield greater efficiencies in factories, they may greatly disrupt labor markets. Knowing this, what skills do you think will be needed to run smart factories, or what should industry be doing to upskill workers?
See, I would take a different view of the question. Rather than thinking that robotics will upend the labor market, I'm seeing that the labor market is actually driving robotics.
Okay.
What we're seeing worldwide, and this is becoming increasingly evident, is that there's a fundamental shortage of labor in the world right now. And in fact, the working age population in China peaked in 2012. It's actually declining in the most populous country in the world. In the West, of course, the developed world, the demographics are rather negative in almost all countries except the US. It's becoming very hard to find workers. When I was visiting Timișoara in Romania, they were complaining that all their workers went to Western Europe. They can't find people. They've expanded their factory.
They're just gone. There's nobody to work.
And it's in Poland, similar kind of thing. They can't find welders. So they created a program to bring working moms into the factory, train them as welders, and take care of their kids.
So they really need to, before they figure out what we need to train, we need to find new pockets of people.
Yes.
Or types of people to come in and be those workers.
Exactly. And absent of that, the only real answer is factory automation, robotics, AI. And that's what people are embracing as a last resort. And we've seen this before.
Sure.
In the late 60s, you couldn't find people. The industry was booming. I was a kid then. I remember that you just couldn't find people, and that's what drove capital spending. People are saying business is really good in the Americas, and part of it is because people can't find workers, and they have no choice but to invest in equipment.
And when you invest in equipment, you can work all day long?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
So let me shift slightly here and talk a little bit about sustainable development.
Right.
So how do you think, what do you think industry support should be around the idea of sustainable development, both green as well as long-term, or setting success in the long run in terms of workforce or technology or investment infrastructure?
To me, this is a classic problem of the commons. We all agree that we should adopt a sustainable approach. But for any one of us or any one company, there's not real incentive to do that.
Right.
Companies in our industry are acutely sensitive to customer need. That's pretty much all we respond to. If someone has a great idea, we don't care unless the customer thinks it's a great idea.
Right.
So while we may have some moral sense that we should pursue a sustainable path, if the customers aren't interested, we're really not going to do very much. But when our customers come to us and say, your machine uses too much power, we will respond. So the question is, why will our customers say that?
Sure.
And is it because they're getting pressure from their customers? Partially. But I think the real answer has to be coordinated effort between governments.
Okay. So it's more a regulatory solution.
Yes, in some way, either taxing carbon, which is a political non-starter, or somehow regulating the energy markets or pollution. We don't pay to pollute. And eventually, we have to change that system. Very hard to do.
Do you see the workforce in terms of, we talked about how there is a scarcity there just a moment ago. Do you feel like the younger workers might only go to companies that are more sustainable, and maybe that's a pressure as well?
I would argue that there is something to that.
Okay.
People in the younger workforce have a different mentality toward these things. So there might be a bias toward going to work for companies that are more sustainable. They also might have a bias toward buying products that are more sustainable.
Which will put the pressure back on the customer again to drive those things.
But I don't think that's going to be enough.
Okay.
Because at the end of the day, we typically drive to work unless we live in one of three cities.
Right.
We're going to drive to work. We're going to live in a house. These are the huge consumers.
People don't want to spend a lot more for their electronics.
Oh,
they want to get them as cheaply as they can.
Sure. So we have to evolve the incentive structure. The best way to do that is through pricing. I'm not sure that's politically doable, but somehow we have to do this as a group worldwide to make the fundamental changes that I think are necessary.
Great comments. Thank you. All right. So, and maybe this ties to what we were just talking about, but how do you feel governments can help industry be more successful, or what should the government role be?
Great question, and it's something that I've been thinking about since I was in grad school in the middle 1980s, and a couple of our professors were talking about this, and Michael Porter is one of the preeminent theologians about creating a competitive environment in this country. Just finished reading a great book by a guy named Alden about this very topic. What is the proper government role? And I think if we look back and take the right lessons from history, we would say that the government's role should not be picking winners and picking losers.
Okay.
We should not have a function similar to what the Japanese had when they were developing, because ultimately it allows an economy to catch up. But that's not helpful in America because we're leading now. The things that an economy needs to be entrepreneurial, innovative, are not typically government directed.
Okay.
But a government can have roles. In defense, the government should be the venture capitalist. But outside of that, I don't think so. The government should create an environment that's conducive to capital formation and growth and other social good things. But there should be a balance. So what specifically do we think that the government should be doing now? And I would argue that number one is immigration.
Okay.
Immigration can be a third rail for a lot of people in our contentious political environment today. But particularly in our industry, I think we should agree that foreign students who come to America for their master's and PhD degrees, particularly in STEM, should be given a pretty simple pathway towards citizenship.
To staying here.
Yes. They are our economy's future, the future entrepreneurs, future leaders. It's the classic immigrant mentality. They come here, they work hard.
Come for the American dream.
Yes.
Right.
And I truly believe that. When you visit our facility, our engineering facility in New Jersey, our engineering department looks like the United Nations. I'm very proud of that. I mean, we hire great people, no matter where they're from.
Well, and there's something also to be said about diversity.
Yes.
Right? I mean, diversity of thought. If you get everybody always thinking the same way, you don't get innovation. You don't get entrepreneurialism. You don't get new ideas.
It's really true. And I heard the words, but I didn't appreciate it so fundamentally until maybe the last 10 years. And now that we have our organization, which is China, Korea, U.S., but U.S. with many immigrants, you start to consider people from a completely different mentality. And they look at issues, and all of a sudden they'll politely question some of our long-held beliefs. You're right. Hadn't thought of that. That's very powerful.
It is. And diversity is more than just where they came from. It's diversity of experience.
Yes.
It's diversity of background. It's
yes.
diversity of, you know, just anything, because
yes.
it brings a new perspective.
Yes. And the danger was, for many, many years, we would hire the same engineer over and over again.
That's right.
And energetic, enthusiastic.
Have
speed.
You done X for the last 10 years? Great. Well, we want you to come do X
you.
For us.
And, well, all of a sudden, what we would wind up doing is we would all hold hands and sprint off a cliff together. Bad.
We live in an increasingly interconnected and globalized world. And the future of supply chain points toward fewer silos and more cross-collaboration. How can companies integrate themselves better within this network?
So this is interesting because we see two somewhat conflicting trends right now.
Okay.
In essence, communications and information flow is now free. which is unbelievable.
Right.
We'll get a dozen people on Skype or WebEx at night, and we'll talk for an hour.
Yeah.
Whereas
the phone calls back when I was a kid, it was like I had to take out a second job
sure.
to talk for an hour.
Wait till after 5 before you call your
grandparents. That's right, exactly.
Yep. And I would get like $100 phone bills for a month and wig out.
I think I wasted an entire scholarship on calling my girlfriend.
Well, yeah, we obviously you didn't marry her then.
Actually, I did.
Oh, then it wasn't wasted.
Well, that's true, yeah.
So, you know, the thing is that when we have this free communication and information flow backing up our computers all the way around the world each night, we become highly integrated. And we create this single brain within our organization where all of us are on a call, all of us are thinking, actively listening, coming up with good ideas, remembering things we did 10 years ago. So that tends to reduce the silos that we've talked about, and we become one team. Great, very productive. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, the situation in trade is changing, and the trade intensity of the world economy is now declining, so that trade as a percentage of GDP is now going in reverse. And what we're seeing is somewhat greater localization. Part of that is to a degree driven, I think, by current trade practice. And unfortunately, I don't think that's going to reverse anytime soon. It may be going in the opposite direction. But I think also that longer term, we're going to have to grapple with the cost of transportation, the environmental cost of transportation.
Okay.
And that will argue for greater localization.
Sure.
And
if you don't have to move it as far, you're
yes.
not going to probably be polluting as much. Yeah.
And people have often asked, where are you going to set up your next factory? Well, it's probably going to be close to an existing market. And that would mean that we're going to be shipping fewer of our large machines on the water. Our transportation goes down, our carbon footprint grows down. But that either allows or creates a greater silo. We'll be differentiating more locally while we're thinking more globally. The phrase we use is global.
Sure.
Global and local.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not that you're moving away from being a global organization. It's about serving a global organization where they're at.
Yes, yes. And it's, you know, it's interesting. Some of our customers are truly local, mm-hmm. and others are sort of, we'll call it poly-local. They'll have their Mexico, their Germany,
gotcha. So it's more regional-based
yep.
as opposed to actually
yes.
being right there.
Yep, and you have to have the global to handle the corporate,
yep.
and you have to have the local to keep those folks happy, because a team in New Jersey is not going to fix a machine in Penang.
A little tough.
Yep. I mean, we can suggest what the person might do, but you got to have the boots on the ground.
That's right. And so as you go toward this more, let me just call it completely local as opposed to this regional view, how do you envision that happening from a financial perspective? I get the regional, you know, so if I have a plant in Mexico, so I'm close enough, I can kind of move
right.
things there. But if I've got 6 customers in Mexico, how am I putting factories near all 6, or
right.
is that what you envision?
Well, I think the idea is that you have Asia, mm-hmm. and North Asia, South Asia, China, ex-China. You have the Americas, and you have Europe. Those are the major segments.
Sure.
And it's good, you know, right now, and for the last 15 years, everything, the goods have flowed out of Asia. That's probably going to evolve, and I think that many people will start to have low-cost Western supply chains. At first, everything we made up through 2000 was within about 10 square miles of our factory in North Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
We had this great just-in-time supply chain. It was fantastic. I mean, really, 15, 20 minutes, you could hit all of our suppliers. Everything came in just in time. But the costs changed, and after 2000, we started bringing systems in from Montreal. The Canadian dollar was cheap. We started bringing that in, and that worked out real well, especially if you like driving up to Montreal. And
sure.
Montreal is wonderful, but the costs kept on changing. Asia opened up. Everything came from Asia. I think the pendulum is going to start swinging back in the opposite direction. I don't know if the answer is Mexico. I don't know if the answer is Canada. There are people in our industry who are now building in Canada to avoid the import tariffs.
Sure, I mean, and there's a lot of people that have factories in Mexico as
yes,
well for the exact
yes.
same reasons.
Like capital goods in Mexico is new.
Okay.
So to build your car frame, your engine.
Yeah, it's more of the smaller electronic manufacturing pieces that you can push back and forth across the border very easily.
Right, high engineering content, high spec stuff. This is now what we're gonna see evolve.
Interesting, very good. And so for my final question, what do you think as an industry we should be talking about, but we're really not?
Sustainability.
Okay.
And sustainability is near and dear to my heart. I will admit that I have occasionally been a tree hugger in life. And in 1975, I wrote a paper for biology class in high school about how increasing levels of CO2 in the atmosphere would impact different plant metabolism and cause evolutionary change. You know, it was a little far-fetched, but it was very clear in the mid-70s that the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere was going up from, 200 part per million to 300 and now roughly 400. Mm-hmm. And what impact would that have? And everybody sort of knew that it might have a greenhouse impact, but now the notion of climate change is not an abstraction. Right. You can sort of see it in your everyday life. And I think one of two things will happen, or perhaps a combination. Either the governments will get together and we will change our behavior, or nature will also
force us to change our behavior
in one way or the other. Yeah. And perhaps we will all vote with our feet and move, and that's what we'll probably do. But to some degree, I think we can evolve our behavior to have less of an impact.
So the industry as a whole needs to put more of the environmental or corporate social responsibility issues or environmental responsibility issues on the forefront of what they're thinking.
So that we can be prepared when the seemingly inevitable happens.
Right, so instead of being caught,
yes,
let's be talking about it now so that when either or some combination of both of these scenario happen, we're already most of the way there.
You know, our industry is extremely responsive to customer input or legislative input. And when our big customers or even our small customers come in and say, I need this, we need to be
ready.
You
want the business, so we're going to go do what your requirements
are. And we don't want to start the engineering when we get the call, because then we're six
You're
months,
behind.
A year too late.
And because the guy next door who has done that, that's where that customer goes.
And we're out of work for a while. So I think that's what we should be focusing on.
Excellent. Dave, thank you for your time today and for giving us a look at what the Factory of the Future holds and how we can prepare. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Find more information on the Factory of the Future.